is this a failure of policy, or is it a failure on Republican elite parts to understand just how high the degree of dislocation is culturally and economically by the changes that globalization has wrought?
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to The ER. Calling into the studio from California is FP columnist Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. And joining me in D.C. is FP's national security correspondent Dan DeLuce and David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So, David, you're a respected journalist. You work for the New York Times, the old gray lady of journalism. And yet, in an apparent contradiction, Donald Trump seems to love you. Why does Donald Trump love you, David?
It's a great question, David. I think the only answer can be that, you know, he respects fairness, objectivity, all of those...
What evidence is there of that?
All those journalistic values that you hold so near and dear.
We do hold those values near and dear. Why does he keep quoting you in his talks?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I think maybe part of it is...
Well, first help the viewers out. What is he saying?
You know, we did a lengthy foreign policy interview with him 2 months ago now. And he's made reference to it on several occasions, usually in the context of saying that the media is incredibly unfair. The Washington Post, as you know, has gotten banned. I think Politico's gotten banned. He said the New York Times hasn't gotten banned yet, but we're right on the edge.
I want to get banned. Dan, okay. What can we do to get banned
Trump? We'll see. You know, by the end of the podcast, I think you probably will have gotten it worked out, David.
Yeah,
you
know? this may be the
this
moment.
Could be it.
I have personally, I mean, as Corey knows, I have personally written things that should have instantly gotten us banned. Corey, where are we going wrong?
I don't know. The only thing I can think is that the reason that David Sanger has this exalted status is the dullness with which that you always accuse him of, David.
Oh, my God.
Corey,
oh my God.
How many years it's been and you've now turned on me.
Oh, my God. Dan, you're pretty dull. Why doesn't he quote you?
I know. I mean, I think I just have to get out of this podcast altogether. This is getting scary.
too late.
And no, it's too late. You're trapped. You're trapped inside the podcast.
Corey, no. I just want to remind you that when you were in the Bush administration and I was writing about your guys' policy, you guys considered the dullness to be an attribute because it meant no one read about what you were actually doing.
That's right. I remember with great joy during the 2000 campaign, someone from the Bush team describing Al Gore as having Norwegian charisma. And Norwegians thought that was a compliment.
As well they should. As well they should. Had the Supreme Court not intervened in that race, think where we'd be today as a country. David, I do want to go back to the point. He keeps coming back to this as sort of a certification of the fact that he's actually, you know, not entirely uncredible as a candidate. You know, he talked to the New York Times, you know.
Yeah.
I find it, you know, like he's grasping at straws at this point as his campaign falls apart, you know, literally in terms of staffing. And most of his foreign policy positions are viewed with incredulity by anybody with above a third grade education.
Now, I think you've actually struck on it, David, which is I think he is looking for ratification wherever he can get it of foreign policy views. And you saw this to some degree in his tweet right after the Orlando event, where the first thing he said was, this shows I was right about Islamic terrorism. Well, what did it show? It showed that Islamic terrorism, I guess what he was saying is he was warning against it. Now, I'm not sure that it was a great revelation to all of us to recognize that people who have pledged allegiance to ISIS and have access to guns are potentially a threat inside the United States. And I think what he is struggling with right now is having to make that pivot between simply declaring in a Republican primary what is a problem for the United States and having to now actually come up with how one would address it. And that's not something that he has ever done before in his life. If you've lived your life as a real estate developer, sorting through policy options, boring as it may be, and more boring, as Corey has pointed out, when I write about them in the New York Times.
When I write them.
That is not the thrilling stuff that motivates his base. And he really doesn't seem to want to go and get engaged and do that right now.
What is so striking for me about Trump trying to hide behind the institutional credibility of the New York Times and of the great David Sanger in particular, is that the New York Times interview he did was catastrophically damning for him. So he is actually banking on people being ignorant of the content of the interview in order to gain the credibility of association with the New York Times.
Well, I got to say, the overlap between the readership of the New York Times and Trump voters is probably pretty limited. I think the overlap between the readership of Foreign Policy and Trump voters is zero. In fact, if you're out there listening to this and you are a Trump voter, turn off your iPhone or your iPod or whatever you're listening for this, because you're clearly making a deep mistake, okay? Because you cannot understand anything about foreign policy and possibly support the idea that this guy should be commander in chief.
David, maybe you should be offering free subscriptions to Trump supporters who are listening to this podcast and want to read about foreign policy.
Trump supporters who want to read about foreign
policy. If we only have 11 listeners, it wouldn't even be a big business decision, David.
First of all, I'm delighted that you've upped the number of listeners to 11. And I do want to use this moment
to— you're redeemed in my view.
To reiterate our offer that if you are one of our 11 listeners and you are interested in proposing a show for us and we actually do the show, we will send you one of the mugs that we have made saying I'm one of FPER's two listeners. We also have one saying I'm one of the nerds that listens to FPZR. So you could choose either
these
one
are
of
so rare that, as Corey and Dan will attest, the people who appear on the podcast don't even get a free mug.
It's actually not true. We've started providing them prior to your most recent arrival, and we will give you one at the end of the podcast.
That's a controversy.
Yeah, it really is. Sanger always going for the swag. You know, it's like wherever.
You know, this is the pay we receive to come here and get abused for an hour, right?
Oh, God. Corey, before I turn to Dan, I want to turn to, you know, you've been among those Republicans who have stepped away from the Trump train or thrown yourself in front of it, depending on how you look at it, and, you know, signed letters and so forth. I noticed that Richard Armitage, one of the most distinguished foreign policy experts in the Republican camp, a former deputy secretary of state, recently said that he's going to vote for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Is there anybody credible in the Republican foreign policy constellation who supports Donald Trump?
No, there isn't. And that's actually one of the few positive signs about the state of the party of Lincoln at the moment, is that with the exception of retired Major General Mike Flynn, I know of nobody who has crossed the line and supported Trump. And I think there are two reasons for it. First is that the commander-in-chief has wider latitude in defense and foreign policy than in domestic policy. So the checks and balances that normally constrain lunatics who are elected to our highest office are less salient on foreign and defense policy, so we're more scared. And the second thing is, whatever one thinks of Hillary Clinton's domestic policy or general cronyism, she is unquestionably going to be a safe pair of hands on foreign and defense policy. I don't know anybody who doubts that she would be calm and judicious, that she was calm and judicious. In fact, I don't think you would have gotten the extension of the mission in Afghanistan after the original three Obama administration Afghan reviews in the first year. If Clinton hadn't sided with Secretary Gates, I don't believe the president would have actually upped Afghanistan in the way he has.
Yeah, well, that's turned out great. We'll come back to that possibly. So, Dan, you're out there covering this. Have you found any pockets of support for Trump in the establishment anywhere?
I have not, except those individuals who are elected representatives. But that's maybe a different category.
But that's a pretty small category there, too, right? Like, who's supporting him? Jeff Sessions?
Yes, the Speaker of the House, sort of. I don't know how you quite define Mr. Ryan's position on all of this.
It depends on what time of day it is, right?
That's
he's
right.
like, I'm for him, I'm against right. him, I'm for his policies, I'm against him.
No, actually, I think he's been quite consistent. He said, I'm for him, but I'm against each of these individual policies that he's described. That's
been every policy.
Yeah, that's been the that's I think been the question, which is, would you consider this a candidate of convenience for him, or would you consider it a moral position to say, I'm going to vote for him because I think it's better than having Hillary Clinton elected, despite all of the things he says that I have to renounce.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing, right, Dan? I mean, the only thing I can think of that's more odious than Donald Trump's policies is Donald Trump.
Yes. Well, many people would agree with you. I mean, speaking of people who have not condemned him or denounced him, is John McCain, someone who has once built his whole reputation around allegedly taking a stand on issues of ethics and integrity. He portrayed himself as the maverick who said
we can't torture people. Kind of batshit after the Orlando thing himself, right? He blamed the whole thing on Obama. He said he was directly responsible for it.
But he thus then also backed off from it, which is a little bit different than what we've seen.
Well, it's like Trump. You know, Trump said—
Trump rarely backs off.
Yeah, although he said, I think the best solution to this would be more guns in nightclubs, which is guns in bars is a brilliant solution to America's violence problem. And then he backed off last week with the tweet saying— something to the effect of, well, I didn't mean everybody in the bar should have guns, just like, you know, guards and employees.
Like the one they had who had a gun and was unable to stop the gunman in Orlando.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I've never seen, the Trump thing's an interesting phenomenon, right? I mean, beside the fact that he's a racist, misogynist, know-nothing, who has no business being a candidate, it's an interesting phenomenon because I've never seen a party so quickly and sweepingly in its policy community distance themselves from their candidate. I mean, policy wonks, there's no, sorry about this, kids who are listening in your dorm room hoping for a career in policy. There is no way to get a policy job in the U.S. government unless you have, at a senior level, unless you have the favor of your party's candidate.
That's right.
And all of these people, I mean, Corey is sitting there saying, you know something? I am just willing to stay out here in Palo Alto, California, eating,
tofu,
alfalfa sprouts.
Yes, right? Yeah.
Halibut sushi, gentlemen.
Exactly.
That's pretty good, actually.
Halibut sushi is pretty good, actually. That's to your credit, Corey. But, rather than going into this administration.
It's extraordinary. I mean, we've never seen this in our lifetimes, this kind of the entire foreign policy establishment in the Republican Party, or even tenuously connected to the Republican Party, refusing, openly saying we are not going to support this.
What about the military?
But there's a slight exception before we get to the military, which is there's a group of principled people like Corey. Corey, this will be the one time I say that, right? Who say we will not serve, right? And then there's a group of people saying, I am very disturbed by what he says, but I wouldn't rule out serving because if he gets elected, I will be the one to moderate his foreign policy and make this all acceptable.
I know who you mean, but name names.
Oh, there are lots of folks. There are lots of folks out there. But, you know, Rothkopf, I don't want to name you, you know, in public for this purpose.
Yeah. I don't think anybody would believe that, even coming from the New York Times. Who has said that? Who is prominent and has said that?
Patrice wrote a piece in Foreign Policy magazine.
Oh, who reads that, Corey? Come on.
And
what did Mitchell say in this? It was interesting.
Wrong, but it was a principal position, which is, I'm not helping him get elected, but if he's elected, I feel a Pape's ability to try and limit the damage by bounding the range. And I think there are good, decent people who will make that choice.
It's a choice that people have faced in other moments in other countries, obviously. It often doesn't work that way, but you could see people having that.
And then you turn to the military, as David was talking about, and they don't have that choice, because if, you know, whoever gets elected becomes your commander in chief and you have to provide them with military advice, and you don't have the option of saying, I'm not taking the job. I mean, I guess you could resign your commission, but
there could be a coup.
It could be.
Well, but they have two alternatives that others don't. First, commander-in-chief is not the sole overseer of the American military. The Congress has an important role to play, as they always remind all of us when we are in the executive branch. So there's the congressional oversight, but there's also the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which bounds the range of what military people can and should do, and was pointed out to Trump when he was arguing that we should be torturing terrorists and killing their families. The Uniform Code of Military Justice prohibits those activities.
Okay, so Dan, tell us what you think is going to happen with military leadership.
Well, the first thing we should look for is what the recently retired military leaders will say. That seems to be like the next thing we see, where we see groups of them or a long list of them publicly coming out saying, we can't support this man because of everything he's saying and his temperament and on and on and on. So that's one thing to look for. I think we will see that. And it'll probably come from retired general officers that you, in the past, you wouldn't think would even wade into politics. I think they are totally alarmed by this guy. I mean, the senior leadership, as you can imagine. There's some exceptions, and there's some rank and file who will vote for him.
But at the senior level in the Pentagon, when people are gathered around the camo water coolers, this is what... This is what they're saying.
They are appalled. They make jokes like we are, but then they also kind of get very serious and solemn and say, you know, this is not on. And I mean, the military actually would not obey unlawful orders, and they know that, and they're taught what are lawful and unlawful orders.
But you know what else he's saying? He's saying a few other things that get him a little bit of support there. I wouldn't say broad support. First of all, when you go to his rallies, and I know David's been at several in the past week, but when you go to those, it's very heavily veterans, right? And he makes a big deal of that. And then he goes out and he says the first budgetary thing he will do is increase the budget of the U.S. military. Now, we could have another discussion here about whether the U.S. military could survive perfectly nicely at the current budget levels if they simply could reallocate how they're spending all of this. And this is more Corey's territory than mine. But he gets big cheers even from some in the military who listen to Donald Trump and think that in a Trump administration, this age in which they're constantly having across-the-board cuts put on the budget would be over.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's truth to that. The people in uniform who are senior and who actually know the facts obviously are skeptical of,
yes,
of what he's talking about.
Yeah, the facts being that the United States budget contains a giant, immovable, and growing object in terms of entitlements that we can't do anything about, at least in the near term, and that therefore is going to squeeze where we have any discretionary spending, and the largest part of discretionary spending is military spending, and therefore something's got to give.
Except that in his world, military is non-discretionary.
Well, his world is the planet, you know, Pluto. I mean, you know, the reality is sooner or later he has to come to Washington, move into the Oval Office, get out a calculator, figure out what's going to happen. And the Congress also has to deal with this stuff. He doesn't get to do things alone. It's not the authoritarian regime that he would like it to be. Look.
Oh, David, your sweet naivete is so inspiring.
I love this. Yes, go on.
You think he's going to be constrained by the Constitution. That's touching.
I kind of do, what with, you know, independent judiciary and a few other factors. But here's the thing. See, I like talking about this because Trump's fucking batshit. And it's like so interesting to have a character like that who's like wandered out of a reality show and onto the, you know, national political stage. It's impossible to imagine how it happened, but it's entertaining to talk about. There's no chance he's going to be president. So we might as well talk about it now, because when Hillary Clinton is president, you know what's going to happen? The same old people are going to be in the same old jobs. Washington's going to look a lot like Washington has looked for the last 20 years. Our foreign policy is going to be pretty sound. The big discussions are going to be, oh, should we do TTIP, you know, a transatlantic trade deal, which most Americans will fall face forward into their porridge after two sentences into David Sanger's story about that.
In fact, do you think I could make TTIP sound exciting, Corey?
I think we ought to have a sweepstakes in which you attempt to do that. And then we can judge whether we have even fewer listeners in the podcast on which you talk about TTIP.
I want to remind you
that Sanger comes on and our listener is leaving in droves. Yes.
I want to remind you that years and years ago, decades ago, I think the New Republic ran a competition for the most boring headline in the New York Times.
Congratulations. I didn't know that you would actually.
I was not the winner. Yeah. It was actually it was an op-ed columnist who had written a column for which the headline was Worthwhile Canadian Initiative. And the best part of this thing was that the prize to the winning submission was a copy of Gerald Ford's A Time to Heal.
You know what? that's a good one. Although my vote would have been for Henry Kissinger's diplomacy, but that's another that's another story. I do love, by the way, just I have to throw this out there. All the Republican columnists, including the ones at the New York Times, twisting themselves into pretzels, trying to find something that they can possibly say that's vaguely supportive of something that's vaguely Republican or conservative at the moment. It's contortionism worthy of a back street in Bangkok.
Well, I mean, it gets to this interesting question, which is sort of behind your statement, David, which is, and when this election is over, does the Republican Party go back to where it was and pretend that this was sort of like an interesting little fling, but it ended and it's over, and get back to their old policy positions? Or does the fact that they have been through this wrenching experience and the splits in the party have been so evident change the party forever? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Corey, you know.
Corey knows the answer. Corey, what's the answer, to this? Corey?
Yes.
If David doesn't know the answer, I don't know the answer.
Look, first of all, the 11 people listening to this podcast are not going to tune back in. Stick your neck out.
My sense is that Republicans have been alarmed by the kind of racist, misogynist, political arsonist that is Donald Trump. And we're trying to, I think there are two big questions we're asking ourselves. One is this a failure of policy, or is it a failure on Republican elite parts to understand just how high the degree of dislocation is culturally and economically by the changes that globalization has wrought? That is this unfixable, or can we find language that re-engages the people who have moved towards Trump because they're exasperated with us saying, yeah, globalization and trade are wonderful. We're sorry your job's never coming back. And I think the second big question is, how do we make our peace with the ways in with the legacies of the Bush administration? That is big government conservatism and foreign policy Wilsonianism, because both of those things are out of step with Republican voters. And how do we touch base again in a way that brings people who have been Trump voters back into a conservative fold? Or is that impossible? And all 12 of us are just going to be the Hamiltonian party.
By the way, Hamiltonian is, you know, what with the Tony Awards, you know, that may be a big that there could be a plus to call yourselves the party of Hamilton. Although
you hate the musical Hamilton, David.
I feel that it is a overhyped musical. Yes. having said that, do you think Washington's going to work any differently after this election as a result of this election? Or is this election, Dan, kind of a one-off standalone clown show and then we're going to kind of be back to where we were?
I think it probably is not a one-off. There is some underlying disconnect. I mean, just the fact that you have both parties now not necessarily in favor of free trade. Hillary Clinton, of all people, is against supposedly.
No, nobody's in favor of free trade during an election campaign.
True.
People are only in favor of free trade once they become in office.
True. But I do wonder whether this whole Trump phenomenon does kind of permanently scar the Republican Party and make it kind of just dysfunctional for a while until it kind of finds itself and whether there's another step to this. I'm not sure this just all passes.
And I think you have to think of the Trump group and the Bernie Sanders group, while they are obviously radically different groups, they both have a commonality in just what Dan is describing here. And so I think the question is actually as potent for the Democrats as it is for the Republicans. You know, that we had all thought, particularly on the trade-related issues, or at least I had thought, that Bill Clinton had changed the way the party thought about these issues. He got NAFTA through. He got China into the WTO. He did some big things that you would not have expected in the time that he was president in the 90s that you would get Democrats to do. And what we learned from the Bernie Sanders element was that a huge part of the party has now gone back to where they were before that NAFTA moment, before the WTO moment, and they have merged up with a big group in the Republican Party that has expressed this through Trump. And I think one ignores that at your peril.
Well, actually, I think you can ignore it if you want, because the reality is this is just the way it was during the 90s. I was a trade official in the Clinton administration. I remember what was going on in the Democratic Party. And I remember that within the Clinton administration, there were people who were actively against trade.
Sure.
Bob Reich would go out and he'd make a statement that undercut everybody else on trade on a regular basis. I remember an incident that took place at one point when Bill Clinton was being pushed by some members within the administration for trade liberalization with China when he had been pushing for more sanctions. And a couple of his senior staffers were standing in his office. And he said, I wish I were running against our policy. So even Bill Clinton was sometimes against his own policy. The Democrats have always been schizophrenic on this. The reality is that the Republicans have grown increasingly schizophrenic on it as the Republican right has gotten bigger. Because the center of the Republican Party has always been the most reliably rock-solid pro-trade portion of the U.S. political spectrum. But as that right wing got bigger and bigger and bigger, Pat Buchanan and Sarah Palin and on to Donald Trump, we've now got this where the Sanders wing, which is just – it's always been there, and the right wing of the Republican Party are – aligned on this issue and have a little bit
of
more
clout. But they're both much more activated. And Corey, I just wanted you to know that back in those days when David was in the Commerce Department, I would go in to interview him.
Yeah.
And he would tell me absolutely nothing. Okay. Okay. And here we are, what is it now, 25 years later, 20 years later? 20 years later from this time, and look what's happened. I'm doing the exact same job I was doing 20 years ago, yeah. And David is hosting the ER podcast.
But Sanger has grown as a journalist, because back in the day when he was writing boring leads about trade articles, that didn't take much. Trade was boring, and he was boring. Now he's writing about nuclear proliferation,
and making that boring.
And that requires real.
Okay, so I have a challenge for our 11 listeners, which is to please write in and let us know whether you think David's career has cratered more than David Sanger's career has cratered, given their two outcomes these 25
years. And they should write this in Car Talk form on the back of a $100 bill. Is that right?
Right. Exactly. And for every $100 bill with one of those received, you'll get a mug.
Okay, crater written on the side. One serious thing, though. I agree with David Sanger's point that what's different is that Republicans are now no longer reliable trade votes. And this matters hugely for the future of TTIP, because one of the big differences between when David Rothkopf was a trade official and the Obama administration is that the Clinton administration actually did the horse trading and congressional work to win NAFTA ratification, whereas I don't believe I see much effort on the part of the Obama administration to work with Congress on this. And that means he's relying entirely on Republican votes that he can no longer count on.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. David, you used to be a Asia correspondent back in the day. I shudder to think what that was like. And an economic.
It was a lot more pleasant than my life as a Washington correspondent, I can tell you that.
Yeah, well, exactly. And an economic correspondent. TPP, gonna happen?
So if TPP can happen, it's got to fit this incredibly narrow window between the end of the election, November 8th, and the end of the Congress at the end of the year.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the end of the election and the end of the Republican Party.
We'll do the end is nigh later. Okay, but assuming that Hillary Clinton won, okay, the following things would have to happen. She would suddenly have to have a revelation on, say, the morning of November 9th that the trade agreement that she supported when she was Secretary of State and failed to support when she was a candidate because she didn't like the directions it had gone, had actually gotten better in the evening after her election, okay? And that they should push it through Congress and she'd make some promises about how they'll pass other things in Congress once she's in office that would ameliorate the effects.
I don't think that's how it'll happen, by the way.
Just that's a long shot.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is Hillary Clinton, the day after the election, is going to go, you know, this has been an exhausting election. I need a break. And she's going to go off to some, you know, vacation spa and say—
Barack Obama is going to have you get this finished.
You get this finished. You know, I'll be back in a month.
Right. And
do
I'll
what
let you know
can.
What I think about that. So already the Obama administration is preparing to sort of thread the needle of this very narrow time period that they would have to go get it done. That said, I think there's only about a 30% chance. And what's interesting is how much you have seen other members of the Obama administration stick their necks out about what disaster will befall if this doesn't happen. You had people like Ash Carter, the defense secretary, say that this is the single most important thing we need to do to tie together the alliances in Asia, which then raises the question, what happens if it does fail?
Oh, that no. It raises another question, Dan.
Yes.
If TPP is the single most important thing we've got to tie together the alliances in Asia,
the
alliances in Asia are in pretty lousy shape.
I mean, yes. I think, though that it would be damaging if this thing fails, and it probably will. And it's damaging on many levels. The perception of the U.S. in the region in Southeast Asia, it will take a hit. And it's actually bad timing, right? Because it would have been really good timing. China's economy is slowing down.
Can we think of any major trade deal that the U.S. has pushed in the past 60 years that has failed?
I can't. I can think of some that have gotten watered down to meaninglessness. In fact, you did some of that watering down when you were in the Commerce Department, as
Thank
I recall.
You, Dave. Thank
Another
you.
Very successfully.
Blow.
You know? However, I can't
Trumpish
think,
in here.
I can't think of any that have actually failed.
Yeah, I can't either. Corey, you're undoubtedly. Corey's going to go back in the Benjamin Harrison administration.
Obscure historical references are my category, but even I can't think of one.
Yeah, but that's an interesting thing, though, because I can't think of a major trade deal that has failed because presidents tend to make them a priority.
And as my colleague Keith Johnson asked, the reverse, which is name me a trade war that was successful.
A trade war?
Yes.
No, trade wars are never successful. Right. The reason that presidents tend to be for trade deals is trade deals tend to be pretty good. They tend to help things. You know, there are dislocations, and nobody wants to acknowledge the dislocations while they're pushing through the deal, because that requires actually spending some money to take care of people. But And I think we haven't done enough of that as we've gone forward. But I think you do bring up an interesting point, which is there's a brief window for this. And then, as Corey points out, after that, Hillary Clinton's going to have a pretty tough time turning on a dime on this trade stuff. It's going to have to wait a little.
I also think, and when we do the podcast 4 years from now, you can tell me how wrong I was here. I think TPP and TTIP are the end of this era of big trade deals, that they take too long to negotiate. By the time you've negotiated them, the issues you're negotiating about have so run out beyond what you're discussing, and they're nearly impossible to get past. And the Chinese have learned this brilliantly by going out and doing individual deals, signing up, you know, bilateral agreements. And my guess is the Chinese style for this is going to win.
Well, so far the Chinese, if you look at the past couple of years, their record's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Because they've gone out, they've negotiated a bunch of arrangements in the region. They haven't done a big deal, but every country in Asia is more dependent on China now than they were in the past, which, by the way, underscores the greater reality, which is it's not trade deals that drive trade. It's economic vitality that drives trade. Trade deals are secondary. And then they've done other stuff like the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank, which have shored up the economic infrastructure of their immediate neighborhood.
And there's almost nothing that the Obama administration has handled more ineptly. And by and large, they've been pretty apt, but more ineptly than the rise of the Asian Infrastructure Bank.
Wow. Wow. That's a second.
That's a big statement.
That is a big statement. We've only got a minute or two left. And I'm gonna bring us to a close on that statement, asking each one of you to name things the Obama administration has handled more ineptly than the AIIB. Corey, I'll begin with you and your answer of Syria. Go on.
Yes, Syria. Yes, Libya. Yes, Iraq. Yes, allied relationships in Europe. But it's definitely a contender. I would only vote for Syria, Iraq, Libya, and allied relationships, because I think the consequence is even bigger than the consequence of the AIIB. But it was a terrible choice, as David says.
Okay, wait a minute. Corey is like getting all soft here, Dan. What about Ukraine? What about Russia? What about North Korea? There are other things that we've handled more ineptly. Dan?
Well, yes, but Syria takes the cake, sorry, in my humble opinion. Given the scale of death and destruction and the wave of migrants, the consequences are just kind of almost impossible to get your arms around.
Okay, I'll briefly disagree by saying that I'm not sure that the other choices that President Obama could have made on Syria would have had a significant difference in the death and destruction, but I would put North Korea right along with AIIB in the badly handled department.
Well, there you have it, folks. There's a little bit of debate here about which of the Obama administration's policies get the big, smelly, steaming cake of poop for being the worst.
My kids are going to like that.
Don't you like how David has raised the level of foreign policy debate in this election season?
I have to say, I was grateful that it wasn't a worse curse.
First of all, I love the term cursing because it makes me feel like we're back in the 50s and I'm one. But secondly, I think we should use colorful language to liven up this discussion. We don't have to be like the New York Times. This is interesting crap, shit, poop. This is interesting. We need to keep talking about it like it's interesting, or those 11 listeners are going to fall right asleep because there's only so much box wine you can drink before losing consciousness, as David Sanger proves nightly.
I'm drinking that foreign policy label stuff you keep sending over to the house.
Yeah, right. Right. Chateau FP.
Yeah, bought from Trader Joe's. But,
exactly.
You won't spend that much.
Well, folks, once again, another podcast has flown by. Thanks for joining us. Join us again next time when we will discuss other depressing developments on the global stage, but do it with a smile on our faces. Thank you, David. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Corey. We'll be back again soon. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori and Ann Kingston. For more information about FP and to subscribe to this and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.